This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
This is a special broad podcast. The United Nations Association of Australia presents National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls. September 5th, 2016. Held here at the Novotel in Melbourne, Australia. This is Mary Crooks, the Executive Director of Victorian Women's Trust at the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, September 5th, 2016. This is Broad.
We're fortunate now to be joined by Mary Crooks, Executive Director of the Victorian Women's Trust. Since 1996, Mary has been Executive Director of the Victorian Women's Trust and has tirelessly championed the rights of women and girls in the quest for gender equality. In 2012, she was appointed as an officer in the General Division of the Queen's Birthday Honours for her, quote, distinguished service to the community through contributions to public policy, particularly in the areas of social cohesion and water sustainability, and as an advocate for the advancement of women. Please welcome Mary.
Leave my coat on because I've got a refreshed cold and it's not all that comfortable. Okay, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this morning and to follow Heather's address. And like Heather, I'm actually going to do some storytelling with a view to making a case for this moment in time in terms of gender equality in this country of ours. We actually have a trust, a third entity at the Victorian Women's Trust called the Dugdale Trust for Women and Girls, which is a national entity for harm prevention work. And the reason we called it the Dugdale Trust for Women and Girls is part of our track record of honouring women who have come before us, recognising the women who have paved the way for us. And Henrietta, in 1884... founded the first suffrage league for women in Victoria to help win the vote. And in the same year, she wrote to the Herald Sun saying that the reason that women in the colony were angry at the violence in the homes and on the streets was that the perpetrators of the violence had a say in shaping the laws of the land while the victims did not. And Henrietta went on to be a magnificent champion for our voting rights. She also formed a wonderful, productive partnership with George Higginbotham at a professional level, who went on to become the Attorney General in one of the all-male parliaments in the late 1880s. And he became a very strong male advocate for change. I think we've just invented the term male champions of change, but George Higginbotham went on to advocate for women's enfranchisement because of his partnership with Henrietta. I think she was also one of the first women to wear trousers in public life. Muriel Hegney, some of you will know Muriel. She was born in 1885, she died in 1974. She campaigned for 50 years, for five decades, for equal pay in Australia. She was a founding member of the Council for Action for Equal Pay in 1937, and she was secretary for most of its 10 years' existence. Muriel understood that wage inequality was the major obstacle to achieving equality of status and opportunity. In 1919-1920, she worked as an investigator for the Federated Unions of Australia in their submission to the Commonwealth Royal Commission on the Basic Wage. In 1923 and 1927, Muriel prepared the cost of living schedules for the Clothing Trades Union in its submissions to the Commonwealth Court of Conciliation and Arbitration for a uniform basic wage. In 1935, Muriel wrote, "Are women taking jobs from men, or are women taking men's jobs?" to counter the propaganda at the time, during the Depression, about the employment of women. In 1948, she wrote Equal Pay for the Sexes. From 1937 to 1948, she was a founding member and secretary of the Council for Action on Equal Pay. Muriel died in poverty in St Kilda in May 1974, a week after the National Wage Case decision granted women an adult minimum wage. Jessie Vasey, born in 1897 in Queensland, married George Allan Vasey, a very decorated Australian Army man. But he died in an air crash, and she herself became a war widow in 1945. In 1947, Jessie resolved that the war widow's pension should be raised to the basic wage. She argued that the war widow's pension was not a charity, but in fact a statutory right, being compensation for the life of a serviceman lost. She formed the Craft Guild, which became a huge cottage industry for women to gather and sew and sell and augment the meagre war widow's pension. It went on, the Craft Guild, to be pretty much in every state and hundreds of branches around the country. She herself was president. In May 1947, the federal government announced an increase in the war widow's pension of 5 shillings a week, pretty much at the same time that they voted themselves another parliamentary salary increase. Jessie rallied war widows at the Melbourne Town Hall, and over 3,000 attended to demonstrate for their rights. She lobbied the Minister for Repatriation. He was unmoved. Claude Barnard said, "Many of these flappers married these men in a hurry, and a lot of them hoped they would never come back." Prime Minister, Labor Prime Minister Ben Chifley defended his minister, and in a not surprising spin, because we're used to it, said that he had been misunderstood. Jessie Vasey rallied against Section 43 of the Repatriation Act, which held that a pension to a war widow could be refused or terminated if the board felt that the grant or continuance was undesirable. Any widow who remarried could have her pension terminated. Any widow who was suspected of having an affair could have her pension denied. To Vasey, this was an intolerable invasion of privacy and was hugely unjust, stripping women of their dignity and their rights to any form of economic security. Vasey and Barnard clashed multiple times in that year until the government, as a result of her persistent lobbying, removed that clause from the Act. Vasey herself said on this morality clause, "If a mother is fond of her children and brings them up right, then I don't care if she sleeps with 10 men a night." Jessie Vasey then went on to actually form Vasey Homes for widowed women. Deborah Wardley, stepping up in time a bit, took on Reg Ansett after she was refused admission to be a pilot and train. And I'll read you out a reflection from Faye Marlitz over that extraordinary case, and there may even be a number of younger women in the audience especially who don't even know the name Deborah Wardley, which is an argument for going back and appreciating our women's history. Faye Miles wrote in a speech in 1997, she was Victoria's Equal Opportunity Commission, she reflected on the Wardley case. "On the 7th of August 1978, I had a diary entry for 3:30 p.m. Deborah handed me a 5-page foolscap account of how she had failed in an application to be a trainee pilot, her experience in the selection process and why she thought she'd been discriminated against. The circumstances she described rang true, and at first glance her claim looked persuasive. It took 18 months from the day when the complaint was lodged to when she began successfully to train as a pilot with ANSET. Over that period, there had been 3 hearings before the Equal Opportunity Board, 2 before the Supreme Court, and 1 before the High Court, simply to earn the right to train as a woman as a pilot. ANSET had employed, not surprisingly, a team of QCs, but a QC represented Deborah on a pro bono basis. For Sir Reginald ANSET, beyond the cost of litigation, there had been extremely negative publicity. He was accused of having been responsible for the worst public relations exercise in corporate history. There had also been a boycott of the airline by women. This is a salutary tale. Maybe we've forgotten the power of boycott. There had been a boycott of this airline by women, and it was estimated that ANSET Airlines lost between 14 and 17% of its business through the case. I suspect there had also been a high personal cost, said Faye, on Sir Reginald as he retired in the latter stage of the case. I read that largely because of the notion of the power of boycott. In 1985, when the Victoria Women's Trust was set up by the then Kaine government with a gift of $1 million to recognise the role and contribution of women across the colony and the state in 150 years of European settlement. So a gift of $1 million was considered by some to be a generous amount, but factoring in what women had done in 150 years of colony building and nation building is sort of not quite up to the mark. But when that all-volunteer board of the Victorian Women's Trust, with the custodial obligation to make that $1 million go well and last, but the first thing they did in about 1987 was to establish the Guaranteed Loan Fund, because this was a time in the mid to late 80s when the commercial banks were not interested in lending to women of low income unless their husbands were sitting next to them as guarantors and co-signing, because the banks deemed that women in this situation were quite clearly a credit risk. So they thought. So the all-volunteer board of the Women's Trust went to the then State Bank, where the $1 million was invested, and said to Bill Moyle at the time, if you're prepared to lend to low-income women in their own right, we will carry 50% of the risk of each loan. So there was an all-volunteer board of women that were prepared to put at risk, not very, it wasn't risky, but they were prepared to put at risk the starting capital of Victoria Women's Trust in order to win the right for women to be assessed for credit by commercial banks. The State Bank agreed. Hundreds of women were marshalled through the Guaranteed Loan Fund, started very successful businesses, and how many do you think defaulted? It appears none defaulted. And the commercial banks, the State Bank changed its way, not its other ways, because it was then debanked, an institution run entirely by men, but all the major banks then changed their ways. From that time onwards, it's been a lot easier, still not unproblematic, but a lot easier for women to access credit for their own economic development. And the final story I tell in that respect is a salutary reminder of the last federal election. When we're talking economic empowerment of women, is to look at the superannuation debate as it was framed. The only issue around superannuation debate in the last federal election was around some fairness at the top small percentage of high contributors or high people with high stakes in the superannuation industry. The superannuation debate, loosely termed, made no reference to the fact that our superannuation system is not, as it's claimed, fair and universal, because it's grossly unfair and is not universal, because the majority of Australian women are locked out of it, either through their part-time, their casualised work, or because the majority of Australian women with legitimate caring responsibilities don't qualify to be part of a superannuation scheme. which goes to the fact that we have still, unresolved in this country, worked out ways in policy and program terms and economic terms how to validate and reward the unpaid work that women do across our communities and our society. But they're still locked out of systems that deny them an entitlement to economic security in their older age for the decades of caring work that they still do. So I think the salutary reminder of that superannuation debate, despite the extraordinary good work of associations like the United Nations Association of Australia and the extraordinary work of women's agencies and campaigners across this country, is that we still haven't got the major issues affecting women's economic security on the agenda. They've gone. They sort of almost got there in the 80s. But they're not on the agenda as anywhere near as much as we would like, despite our struggles. And still, for example, the community debate on family violence, which is to be welcomed in terms of it being a higher order debate, and yes, we know more about the deaths occurring each week in this country in terms of women being killed at the hands of intimate or ex-partners. And we know from police records the temporary and the permanent impairment through life that can result from family violence. And we know the misery inflicted on children. But it's rare still to hear violence talked about in terms of the denial of a woman's right to economic security, education and training and retraining and the right to earn a decent living. So this, apart from some campaigns and some great work by foundations like Safe Futures and Safe Steps and any number of women's organisations, there's still not enough community recognition that one of the insidious impacts of family violence is a lifetime denial of a woman's right to economic security unless there's interventions and proper supports. What these stories that I've read out today, what they tell us is that there have been decades and decades and decades of struggle by women, with assistance from men at times, of civic engagement, of lobbying, of committed endeavour, but always coming up with huge bastions of resistance and the conservatism that goes with a male-dominated political culture when it comes to sharing power with women, and then to be making a recalibration of policies and programs if women have muscled in. There have been failures, some spectacular failures, despite women's good intent. There's been spasmodic success, and in fact there have been some notable successes. And we are, as the saying goes, standing on the shoulders of giants across our women's history. But you'd think that standing on the shoulders of giants is great in terms of honouring the women and the endeavour that they put in for us. But standing on the shoulders of giants also gives us, surely, a greater view across the terrain and the journey that's to be taken. If we're higher than the giants herself, or themselves, we should in fact be processing what's gone wrong, what's gone right, and are we prepared to accept the same fitful progress around social change and justice for women, which fundamentally hinges on their role in terms of economic security. So we have a greater view, actually, going forward as to whether or how we are to achieve economic empowerment of women and the associated rights that go with that. So some of the lessons, I think, we know, for example, it's not questioned that the safety of women is a key to their lifelong economic opportunity and that of their children. We know that the pay gap persists. The pay gap that Muriel Heckney worked for 50 years is still there and it's not going away. We know about the unfairness of our superannuation system. We know, for example, that Australian women in the system have half the balance, the superannuation balance of male counterparts, let alone the women who are locked out of the system, the more marginalised groups of women including our First Nations women. And we know, for example, that economic insecurity is one of the things that dogs a lot of women as they move into retirement, their twilight years, because they have in fact largely been the major caregivers, unpaid, unremunerated, not in halls of fame. We know all of that. We know about sexual harassment in the workplace. That's not going away either. So we know all of this. So the question now in 2016 and beyond is, what are we going to do about it? So for a start, we have to keep working the evidence. We have to keep pushing the evidence up in front of other women and men and those in institutions and structures of political power. We have to keep working with the structures and the levers of power. One of the things that troubles me a little bit in the emergence and the unbridled flourishing of social media and women's participation in social media, I'm not a Luddite, and I can understand the fever and the frenetic activity around Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. But I'll tell you what, there's also a danger, an attendant danger, that there are generations coming through now of younger women who are attracted to feminist values and notions of justice for women, but if they're not careful, they will become inward-looking and introspective rather than grappling with the levers of power and the structural change that has been grappled with and is the only way that we'll achieve justice and economic empowerment of women. It won't be achieved by having 37,000 followers on Facebook. Seriously, unless half of those 37,000, as a result of their engagement through Facebook, are starting to go out and work the external environment that creates the oppressive structures in the institutions and the pockets of resistance that keep women down on these issues. Fundamentally, though, the pace has to quicken, the pace of change. It almost seems as though we're treading water, despite best intentions, despite the evidence, despite our passion and our commitment. It feels as though the pace is not right. The pace is too slow. Do we really want to wait another 70 years for gender parity in our cabinet? Or are we happy to accept former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's words that women keep knocking on the door, good women keep knocking on the door? Do you want to keep knocking on the door in the hope that they might open the door and might let Maurice Payne in to be a Defence Minister? Or do we want to actually start to assert our entitlement? Joe Hockey, a couple of years ago, made a very weird speech in Hong Kong and in London. Well, he made several. But this was the most weird, and it was the one that was... Interestingly, it was the one least picked up by the media, even though it was dynamite in the speech. But he made the speech in London called The End of the Age of Entitlement. And in it, he argued that he'd been to Hong Kong the year before. It's amazing what international travel does to one in terms of expanding horizons. But he made the comment that the Hong Kong welfare system was fantastic and the only true model of sustainability. In effect, because, guess what, there was none. That was his message. By all means, go and read it. In 2012, he made that speech. But in effect, he was saying that we can't afford, as a state, we can't afford to have systems where so many people are dependent on the state for support and welfare, and we had to contract all of that. But I'm reminded of that as I wind up my speech, because I'm thinking we should claim that word entitlement as women. We should claim it from now on if we haven't already worked on that basis, because we are entitled to be safe. We are entitled to a fair share of the economy. We are entitled to be covered in a superannuation system that says it's fair and universal. We are entitled to be free of sexual harassment in the workplace. We are entitled to be secure in retirement if women, for especially, have worked in unpaid work all of their lives, doing one of society's biggest, most demanding jobs. We are entitled to these things, not please give us a crack at them. We're entitled to them. I just think that we need to shift the dial a little bit in terms of what we want and how we're going to go for it. And systems like Wendy and Sophie and staff of the United Nations Association of Australia are being able to report on the status quo. Although I'm reminded of Herbert Hoover's wonderful statement once that why would you keep supporting the status quo if the status was nothing to quo about? But keep reporting on it as a way of holding our governments across the globe accountable for their responsiveness or their lack of responsiveness to goals affecting the status of women. But I just think that we have to see that we are at a moment in time where we need a lot more cut through. Enough is enough. We know the evidence, we know the issues. So I think it's now a question of how do we actually get smarter, sharper strategies? It's not just about the equal representation of our women in parliaments. It's much greater than that. It's actually making our parliaments and our corporates and our community agencies pick up and work for the inclusion of women in every aspect of economy, politics, community life. So let's go forward with a very positive and constructive view of entitlement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. Those wonderful stories really do bring women's history to life. And that's inspirational on the one hand, but I think that we should heed Mary's point, enough is enough. So in that vein, questions for Mary before we move on?
Thanks, Mary, for that. Just picking up on your point about social media, thinking about certainly there's the fact that young people and young women in particular may rest their happiness on having 37,000 million followers, although some of those will be politically engaged, but then there's also enormous cohorts of young people utilising social media to activate communities and policies and so on. So moving on from that, I just wondered what your comments are on some of the observations and research that social media is actually maybe not quite bringing down some usual institutions, but changing the way institutions like politics in particular work and business and the workplace.
Yeah. And look, you know, maybe I didn't qualify my position enough. I'm not anti. I'm not anti-social media, but I'll give you an example, actually, close. I had a coffee with a younger woman on Saturday morning, and she's a mum with two kids. She's on maternity leave. And she actually... she enjoys the whole social media arena, but she took on Target recently over a sexist T-shirt, because it was a Batgirl T-shirt, and Batgirl can now, her tasks for the day, do the dry cleaning, wash the Batmobile, and so on. Anyhow, but what she did was to actually contact Target in a very constructive and civil fashion, and they took it off the shelves. So that was great. But she's also someone who has a understanding of the need for activism and not just talk. That's who Nina is. But what was interesting to me was the support she got, yes, but also the hideous blowback from women and men. And what I worry about is that to only operate or largely operate in that sphere, it's actually really tough because it's hard to put up with that kind of hurt when people lacerate you, it's hard at the best of times. But when people do it anonymously and vitriolically and without working the evidence, the danger is that it actually ends up stymieing the best intentions of activist women, that they might in fact say, I'm not going there, it's too awful. So I'm glad you asked me the question, because I've got a chance to put my position that I'm not a Luddite most of the time. But I just think that if we're not careful, there are incredibly important pathways, activist pathways, that are tried and tested. And we need to keep on those pathways, which are about wrestling with levers of power and not lowering the bar and getting down and dirty with people who are not interested in evidence, they're just interested in opining, they're not interested in civility, they're not interested in respect. And I think it's really important that younger generations of women coming through with feminist values must be very, very watchful and careful that the integrity of their activism isn't contaminated and dissolved by this hateful kind of stuff that's out there. That's my point.
Mary, can I just say thank you for making that point? My name's Melinda Salento. I'm the co-chair of Reconciliation Australia. And I'm going to just follow up on that with wearing two different hats. One is in that role, and we oversee the Recognise campaign in support of constitutional recognition. But the other is as a mother of three daughters. The need for resilience in social media is extraordinary, and I don't think it's spoken about enough. The things that you observe, the comments that I've seen posted in the Recognise campaign, for example, personally directed at people, there is no respect. The things that are said are unbelievable, and the resilience that's required to continue in the face of that is just unbelievable. So it's an incredibly useful medium. It can be very, very effective, but wade in with your eyes wide open, and I think we all have a responsibility to empower younger girls to understand that and to know how to use it, but also how to deal with it. And as a mother of daughters, my eldest daughter has actually taken herself off social media because, one, she thinks it takes up too much time, but two, because even in a friendship circle, people say things on social media that they would never say to each other's faces. And it gets picked up by others, and it allows others to say the same thing. So it's a great tool, but it can be incredibly corrosive. And I've seen how it influences people who are trying to drive positive change when the lowest common denominator takes over. So I think it's a really, really important point.
Yeah, I think, thank you. It goes to theory of change and social change as well. And, you know, I mean, I think that the social change is invariably more incremental than it is revolutionary, but at the same time, if women want to share power and to use their power and to express their power in our society, it's the structures and the institutions and the levers of power that have to be wrestled with. The dominant male hegemony in this country is not going to turn around and say, oh, hey, Christopher, hey, Malcolm, hey, Bill, why don't you give women a bit more power? It's just not what they're going to say or do. It is about relinquishing some of the power they have become accustomed to using and relinquishing it in the interests of inclusion and the participation of women. So this is a structural, institutional view of how change occurs, and it doesn't change simply because there's talk. It changes simply because there's action, and that's why the stories of, you know, I mean, Muriel Hegney, you could say maybe cynically that all of her 5 decades of effort amounted to nothing because we still have a pay gap, but I would think that when Muriel published her treaties of women taking men's jobs, it actually had a huge impact at the time, nationally. Now, it mightn't have borne fruit in terms of policy change, but she did one thing in publishing that that led to an altered state of consciousness and an inspiration to other women and so on. And that's what it's about. It's about all the time grading the road so that others can come in behind it. So my interpretation would be that I think this is the time when we need to look back on everything but also say we're not happy with the pace of change. We're actually not happy with that, and we're going to actually do our best to work more sharply in a more defined fashion if the cause is so just.
Thank you very much, Mary. I think those are excellent closing words for us, and let's take that drive with us through our dialogue in the next day and a half, that we are not happy with the pace of change, that if we want power for women and we want to empower women, then we are going to need to work those structures and levers of power. Very wise words, I think. Please join me in thanking Mary.
Thanks for listening to this special podcast from Broad on Joy 94.9 at the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, held at the Novotel in Collins Street, Melbourne. It ran from the 5th to the 6th of September 2016. And thanks to the United Nations Association of Australia and Sophie Arnold.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune in to us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.